Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
You're listening to the BBC World Service, and now it's time for more in our extreme season. We take a look at a city that's historically been one of the most corrupt in the United States, thanks to a political machine that long controlled democracy there. Local journalist Steve Edwards is our host for Oiling the Machine.
I'll never forget my first election. I was elected to the state legislature, and I called my mother, and she said, "You know, now, son, I want you to promise me you'll always be for the people." I said, "I will. And I want you to promise me, son, don't ever take a bribe." And I said, "Don't you worry, I'll never take a bribe." And then the next thing she said to me was, "Good, son, I know you won't. Let me ask you another question." And I said, "What's that, Mama?" And she said, "Can you get Aunt Daisy's son-in-law a job?" So my mom, I think, reflects how people here in Chicago kind of see that old school Chicago politics, which is when you get to office, it's all about taking care of your family.
That's former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who's about to face trial on corruption charges. He insists that he's innocent, and so it may prove. But if he does end up in jail, he'd become the fourth state leader in 50 years to serve time for graft. My name's Steve Edwards, and I live and work in Chicago, Illinois. The BBC's given me 23 minutes of its airtime to find out why this city's got such a problem with corrupt public officials. And the Windy City has proved to be one hell of a shady place. I've just turned 40, and in my lifetime alone, Illinois has seen more convictions for public corruption than there are seconds in this entire program.
You know, he finally says, "Well, you know what? I'd like to put you on a retainer for $1,000 a week." And he pulls out an envelope and he says, "Here, I'd like you to have this."
When I went to prison, people said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Chicago." And they said, "Oh, Chicago, that's daily corrupt politics and Al Capone."
Former Chicago Alderman Ed Vrdoliak is expected in court today to be sentenced again. Vrdoliak pleaded guilty to using his influence on the board of a local medical school. He sold a piece of their land to a real estate developer.
Yes, Chicago is a rough and tumble political neighborhood. For decades, it was ruled by the so-called machine, the local Democratic Party organization that handed out jobs and favors in return for votes. They used that clout to elect mayors, governors, and local council officials known as aldermen. Few people could succeed without the machine's approval. And today the machine lives on in a legacy of brutal political self-interest, as Illinois State Senator Ricky Hendon, author of the book Backstabbers, made very clear to me.
Let's say that hypothetically I want to challenge the incumbent alderman in my ward. We'll call it just hypothetically the 51st ward because it doesn't exist.
Right.
What am I up against? What are the tricks I'm going to face?
Well, the first thing you'll probably face is some building inspectors come to your property and write you up tickets for nonsensical things that they wouldn't write up your neighbors about. People who would donate money to you will get phone calls. Don't donate to Steve. You know, you don't want to do that. It's bad for business. Those things happen. People who you thought were with you will be going back telling the opponent everything you plan and everything you do.
You mean my buddies, my supporters, they're actually spying on me?
Absolutely. That's why I call my book Backstabbers, because that's what happens. They'll stab you in the back.
What happens when I put out lawn signs all over the ward touting my name?
Oh, we steal them. Middle of the night, you wake up the next morning, you don't have a sign anywhere. They're gone.
Anything else that I'll face in this? You're dissuading me from running at this point.
Well, I'm just telling you like it is. I want you to run. Get my book, Backstabbers. It'll show you how to get around all these things. Backstabbers, Chicago Academy Publishers. I think it's about $15.95.
Message received loud and clear, Ricky. But why is Chicago politics so dubious?
City, state, and nation join to honor Mayor Cermak.
Conventional wisdom dates the modern Democratic machine to the interwar mayoralty of Anton Cermak before he was killed, some say, by the mob.
Governor Horner of Illinois attended the rites, and so did Senators Diedrich and Lewis.
Cermak took over and consolidated a number of smaller political groups in the early 1930s, but the foundations for graft were laid long before that.
In order to understand the current makeup of politics in Chicago and the culture that exists today, we have to go back to the early days of this city. To do that, we come to the corner of Clark and Monroe, right in the heart of Chicago, to talk with historian Richard Lindberg. Richard, it's great to see you.
Steve, it's my pleasure to stand here on this historic corner with you.
What is it that makes this corner so historic?
This particular location at Clark and Monroe, the northwest corner, was the headquarters of Michael C. McDonald, the political boss of Chicago and the architect of Chicago's fabled democratic machine, the underpinnings of which really began in 1873 when Mike McDonald opened a deluxe gambling emporium and liquor depot that he called affectionately the store. He did not want to see that continuously raided by police and have his gambling tables chopped up, so he simply had to buy political protection.
How did Michael McDonald actually control political power? What were the steps? Because it's one thing to say it, and it's another thing to actually figure out how to do it.
Politics was run out of the saloon in the late 19th century. Polling places were conveniently located in the back rooms of saloons, and the saloon owners had a vested interest in fighting prohibitionists and temperance advocates who were looking to impose heavy taxation on them or to close their establishments on Sunday. So it was in their interest to form trade associations. And these trade associations amassed a large war chest of money that they could distribute to cooperative politicians, not to mention a built-in voting base.
Well, guess what? To find out more about this tavern culture, I've come to a tavern. It's the oldest one in town, actually, called Schaller's Pump. Now, in the early days of Chicago, taverns like this were all across the city, serving the rapidly expanding immigrant communities, like the Irish and the Czechs. Elections to choose city aldermen, for instance, would even be held in places like this, where the ballot was anything but secret. So far, so sleazy, right? But it turns out that this source of Chicago's political corruption was at least partly the result of good intentions, once.
In many ways, this idea of corruption is not necessarily just a Chicago problem. It's a human problem, and it comes out of a sense of community.
Dominic Pasiga is an expert on Chicago's early immigrants. He says it was old-world welfare, not cynical self-interest, that played into Chicago's early politics.
Remember, a lot of these people come from a communal culture. They come out of small towns in Ukraine or Poland or Ireland, where one hand washes the other, where there's always the look for the good man who will help the poor. This idea of noblesse oblige, you know? So if you were poor, you went to the alderman for a favor. If you needed a ton of coal, you got a ton of coal. If you needed a turkey for Christmas, you got a turkey for Christmas. What did that make you? That made you loyal to that man. The downfall of the machine in every city except Chicago was the rise of welfare state. These machines could no longer take care of these kinds of issues during the Great Depression. In Chicago, however, the mayor, especially after Anton Cermak's assassination in 1933, were able to sort of finesse the federal largesse and say, well, this money's coming into the city of Chicago, but we control who it's going to help. And so it solidified loyalty to the machine.
And so, through a history of organized crime and imported rural social values, the Chicago way was established. Mutual backscratching between politicians, businesses, and voters. The way it worked was this. Politicians and their streetwalkers, known as precinct captains, made sure electors got the city services they needed. In return, they notched up promises of support at the ballot box, or help with rounding up the Democratic vote. But over the years, the protocols got entrenched. Things became expected, and favors withdrawn if you didn't play ball. Present-day Alderman Dick Mell.
At one time, we used to give garbage cans out, steel garbage cans. And I had a precinct captain who was unbelievably hardworking in the job that he did. Wayne would never cast less than 90% in a primary. And so I get a call, a frantic call. Alderman, please, tell Wayne I'm sorry. I couldn't make it back to vote. The car broke down, and my husband, we wanted to vote. We always vote. Please, please, would you tell him to bring the garbage cans back? He went over to their house, took the garbage cans, dumped them out, and took the cans away because they didn't come out to vote.
I saw the operations. I saw it firsthand. I was a precinct captain, and I was there when precinct captains were delivering hams just before the election or turkeys.
Jim Lasky, who went from precinct captain to elected official to jail. Comparing his experiences with those of Dick Mell, who has stayed on the right side of the law, you see how easy it is to cross the line from unofficial agreements between people and their politicians to downright illegality.
And then I saw, you know, how absentee ballots were changed where you punch a chat out and you replace it with super glue on another hole. The precinct captain controls the election judge and the checker. So I've seen people vote multiple times.
I first got elected and guy comes in with his son. And he's got a lunch bag. And I tip it upside down. It's $5,000. He wanted to get his son a job as a truck driver with the city. And I told him, look, I've got an awful lot of people who've helped me get elected, and if I'm going to help anybody, I'm probably going to help them first.
The precinct captain is supposed to go and take the dead people off. So what they do is when they find out somebody dies, they leave them on the poll sheet. So then when you go to the judge or the checker, your name, Joe Blow. Well, Joe Blow died, but they don't know that.
I played by the rules that existed at that time. And the rules that existed at that time is that you could help people within your community find employment with the city.
Driver's tests. We knew people at the Secretary of State's office where, you know, you can get your driver's test taken care of, your written test. Check, 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 check. Oh, yeah, you passed. Go ahead.
Is it favoritism? It is. What else do I do? Do nothing.
Moral ambivalence flourishes when scrutiny is weak. And the informal arrangements between Chicago's people and their politicians have proved ideal for those who want to break the rules. Neighborhoods here have historically been ethnically distinct, like this Mexican-American neighborhood, and so entire communities could be co-opted or played off against one another. The Irish, for example, were often given jobs in the police, the Italians on the city's transit system. And that brings me to another ingredient in the city's recipe for corruption, a large public sector offering plenty of patronage.
Since we don't have a multiple party system and we have a large public sector, I think that it does lend itself to corruption and perhaps more than countries that have less to give around.
Maria de Los Angeles Torres, professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
I remember looking at the numbers in the early 80s and just our police force was larger than the city of Atlanta, Detroit, of their entire city government. So that was just one of 50 departments. So we do have a broader public sector. Now that public sector also responds to the need to feed the machine, right? Because you feed the machine by creating jobs for people. And therefore, it's a cycle that you can't break. The machine needs more jobs need the machine. And so it just keeps sort of spiraling out of control. If you had a multi-party situation or a more contentious and transparent electoral process, that would not necessarily be the case because then people would compete. At least we'd like to think they'd compete in trying to have a more efficient government.
So it can be easier to be corrupt in a city in which one party dominates all of politics. And in the city of Chicago, the Democratic Party's control of matters here is unassailable. So I've come to the opposition, the Republican Party, the opposition party. In fact, we've actually come to meet with the entire City Hall Republican contingent.
Hey.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Good to see you. This is Brian Doherty, who's the alderman of the 41st Ward here in Chicago. And Brian, you are the only Republican on the city council, correct?
That is correct.
So what's it like to be the sole Republican inside a city council and an entire party operation that's so dominated by Democrats? What's that mean for you?
Well, sometimes you have to work a little harder to get your votes because we don't have the patronage and they controlled all the apparatus for a long time.
In thinking about the role of an alderman, does this particular kind of office and this particular municipal structure lend itself to more opportunities to cross the line?
Yes, if you wanted to, it would be very easy. You'd be surprised how many people try to put cash on my table.
Seriously?
Yeah. Most of the aldermen that get in trouble, most of them had to do with land use and planning and zoning, what you're allowed to build. So if you have the property that is zoned, you know, for single-family homes, and I want to put an 80-unit condo in there, we have the authority with the pen to allow that to happen.
But Doherty believes fewer corrupt decisions would succeed if there was a vibrant political opposition to scrutinize aldermen and maintain vigilance.
Our whole system is based on checks and balances. And one of the problems that we are experiencing in the city of Chicago, and more so in the state of Illinois, is there is no checks and balances. The Democratic Party controls the governor, and they control the Senate and the House by large majorities. So they can really pass and do what they want at will.
Well, I'm going to tell you about Patrick. I know it's dead. I went to the graveyard.
With no official opposition, at one point the Democratic Party turned on itself. In the 1980s, Mayor Harold Washington came to power to try and end patronage and corruption.
I said, patronage, patronage, where are you? And Patrick didn't answer. And you know why? It's dead, dead, dead.
Significantly, Harold Washington was black. The machine, it turned out, was not really working for many African Americans. It treated them as little more than ballot fodder for the Democratic Party.
We delivered for the machine, but the Democratic machine did not deliver for us.
Veteran civil rights activist Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Blacks were controlled. They could vote, but controlled through a very sophisticated political mechanism that gave out temporary assistance jobs. If you wanted to be a policeman or a fireman or be promoted in the school system or become a judge, you had to go through the machine. So blacks here were controlled. Harold Washington had learned the experiences of being in the machine, but his heart was not there. I remember talking with him at one point length about how he resented it. Therefore, one of the first things he did was to break up that system.
But when corruption's entrenched, it's not that easy to dismantle. The self-serving machine fought back, even fielding its own mayoral candidate against Washington. And though Harold Washington did end some of Chicago's worst excesses, graft lived on in the granting of big city contracts, so-called pinstripe patronage. By now, kickbacks had become a normal way of doing business for some, and straight bribery remained very much alive, as Jim Lasky found out.
When he gave me the $500, it was wrong, but I took it. And from that point on, every time he was doing well, it was $500 here, $1,000 here. So when all was said and done, when I got indicted by the FBI, it came out to about $48,000 that I took over about a three-year period of time. People say, well, Lasky, you should have known better. Well, you follow the lead, and you kind of like, okay, this is what the system's all about. People showed me how to do these things, and you know what? I thought it was good politics. I thought getting votes for your boss, good politics. You know, bribing people with money at election, good politics. Changing votes, dead people voting. I mean, getting city services by paying people off or, you know, whatever. Good politics.
So we've got a long history of corruption, an all-powerful political party with no real opposition, impoverished immigrants in tight-knit communities trying to give themselves a leg up, and plenty of goodies to spread around. That's a great recipe for endemic corruption. But there's also something else, without which Chicago's reputation might have changed decades ago. People here tolerate corruption.
This is Chicago. This is Al Capone town.
He ain't going to change it. He ain't going to do nothing with it.
It's going to be like that another 100 years.
It's always going to be corruption everywhere.
Politics is always corrupt, right? So, I feel like it's just more notorious here, but it is what it is probably everywhere.
It's always been that way since the beginning of time. So if you want to change it, good luck. It's not going to change.
I think there's something in the DNA here. I think there's something in the water. I believe there's a culture of corruption in Illinois. I think we like our crooks. We like our fast eddies, and we find them entertaining. And I think in some respects that plays into the tolerance angle for it.
Patrick Collins is a former U.S. prosecutor who's also heading a commission to reform public ethics in Illinois.
But here's the problem, Steve. There's a quid pro quo. In other words, if you want your garbage pail, which we all should get, you have to vote or knock on doors or work a precinct on Election Day. That's the Chicago way, and you're smiling as I say this because there's...
Well, it sounds so familiar, you know.
Well, but there's this notion that's, hey, you know, what's wrong with that? You know, and it's the lifeblood of democracy. And you're smiling and I'm chuckling, but you know what? It's not funny, Steve, because corruption costs, not just the taxpayer money. In other words, contracts and leases are 10% higher because part of that is a kickback or because there's not competitive bidding. I mean, that's certainly the financial cost. But the worst situation, and frankly the part that motivated me as a prosecutor to dig deeper, was this man, Scott Willis, who in 1994 was driving a van from Chicago to Wisconsin. The man driving ahead of him had purchased his license for $1,000, his driver's license. He had paid a cash bribe to basically get past the road test. He dropped a part of his load. Mr. Willis drove over it. It punctured Mr. Willis's gas tank, and six of Mr. Willis's children were incinerated right there on the spot.
One of the reasons Chicagoans often tolerate a level of corruption here is because the costs of corruption are often invisible. After all, the unofficial motto of Chicago is the city that works. Take, for instance, the public transit system. Take also, for instance, downtown beautification efforts. Experts say if we want to clean up government in Chicago, the people here must go beyond the surface and focus on the costs.
If you do not do a systematic change, you just pass a law or you elect Joe Smith, who said he's running to end corruption, it's not going to work. This is a systemic, historic system. And we have to have a full frontal assault. It will take at least a decade and probably two. And it will take a united will on the part of the citizenry to carry it through.
Dick Simpson, political scientist and former uncorrupt alderman. Little by little, he believes Chicagoans can clean up their city, but it's up to the people to take the lead.
After each scandal, the public gets all outraged, and usually we will make some modest step forward. But to actually change the culture of corruption, in my estimation, takes no silver bullet. It takes a series of actions. It takes electing new public officials who run on reform platforms and carry them out. It takes changing specific laws. It takes changing the administrative mechanisms. Over time, just like over time we built up the expectation of corruption, over time you can cure it. But as Alderman Berdoliak, who has been convicted and is about to go to jail, once told me on the council floor in a debate we were having, if you're going to fight the machine, you better bring lunch. It's not an easy task.
My BBC minutes are nearly up, so time to consider the lesson of Chicago, where the political machine lives on. People here pledge to tackle corruption, but so far it seems there's not the concerted will to do away with it once and for all. History, traditions, the public sector, and a one-party city have all played their part in the problem. But only by ordinary people showing zero tolerance for sleaze will this, or any other city, ever end the laundry list of corrupt public officials.
Oiling the Machine was presented by Steve Edwards. The producer was Mike Gallagher. This is the BBC World Service.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.